Thank you. And welcome. So we haven't had our little gathering for a couple of months. Today is December 4th, 2012. And how many of you are expecting the world to end on the 21st of December? 50-50. 50-50? Could go either way. Más o menos. I was reading a thing where the in Guatemala, where the Mayan culture was one of the major seats of the Mayan culture, that whole area, southern Mexico, Yucatan Peninsula, down into Central America. And they're advertising it like crazy to bring, you know, busloads of people into Guatemala for the event, 21st December. And the Mayan elders who are there are very upset by all of this to-do, this whole promotion, propaganda. Because, like they say, and what I've been saying for quite some time, for several years, it's just the end of a calendar cycle, and it begins another calendar cycle. That's what they're saying. It's not, you know, the Earth is not going to shift out of its axis. It's not going to be the North Pole in Ireland. And Denver, Colorado will not become beachfront property necessarily by the 22nd. We'll see. But they're very upset that all these people are being brought in and this whole thing is being propagated. Because as far as they're concerned, all it is the end of a particular cycle. Just like December 31st is the end of a cycle each year. So, the other thing I've been saying for some time is, if we've never followed the Mayan calendar ever before, we've paid no attention to it, and now it's the most important thing on Earth. So what's going to happen on December 21st? Anybody have any predictions? What's actually going to happen?
They will follow the next day.
What's that?
They will follow the next day.
They will just the next day will just come.
Yeah.
I think so too.
The importance of the Shereen Mubarak Atomic is that the world isn't ending for another 100 years, 10 million years.
Yeah. Even Kali Yuga, the Iron Age in which we find ourselves, that is just the end of the Iron Age in 427,000 years. And then the Golden Age reappears. It's just like when winter ends, spring begins. Namaskaraji. So, anyway, we'll have to stay tuned. Clindy and I, we are so worried about it that we're going to be up in an airplane just to make sure that we're above the Earth when it happens. No, I'm teasing. We are going to be up in an airplane, but not for that reason. We're talking about December 21st in the Mayan calendar.
People say it's going to be 3 days. Like a dark, yeah?
3 days of darkness?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, that's probably up in Sweden. Standard.
They said everything's going to be aligned.
Yeah.
Like galactic alignment.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. It's only a few more days.
Yeah, exactly.
Mercury was retrograde in the sky, in case any of you noticed from... Oh, it's the date. November 6th. Pardon me. November 9th? November 6th to November 26th. Which was a particularly intense retrograde Mercury. Did you notice that at all? Any problems with machinery or travel or anything to report? Your ship's engines work okay, Frank?
Great, so they got me home.
That's good. It took me 48 hours to get back from Mexico. 2 days. So I got nailed on that one. But we heard a lot of stories of Mercury retrograde this particular time. So when Mercury goes retrograde, it goes into backward motion. And then one can have problems in anything that is ruled by Mercury, which is travel, communication, machinery and equipment, particularly telecommunications equipment, computers, phones, or one of our computers stopped functioning, something, one of its features stopped working.
The car broke down.
I remember a client in Hawaii telling me that one particular Mercury retrograde period, a gecko got caught in the computer, got inside the workings of the computer. So they managed to remove that gecko, and then the next Mercury retrograde, another gecko got inside the computer. Yeah, you know, a little lizard. Yeah. And, but this one got fried out. So that destroyed the whole computer. They had to put in a new motherboard, whatever. Okay, so we'll see what happens. Does anybody have any transcendental inspiration that they want to share with us? Transcendental experiences? Coincidental experiences, serendipitous occurrences. Anybody? Something wonderful happened in your life? God appeared and he said, what?
My mother passed away last week too.
Oh.
Well,
sorry to hear that.
The reason I'm saying it is because I think it was a wonderful experience.
Mm. Were you there for it?
Yeah. At home, so peaceful. It felt like God was all around. It felt like it was just such a lovely time.
Wow.
Coming up to us. Because it's so prepared and so we knew it was days, you know.
Who just passed like 3 months ago? Who was that?
Dad.
Right.
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah. So now who's remaining?
No, that's it. No, that's the last.
Is it? Oh.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
But having the preparation and knowing what was coming and...
How did you know? What did she, was she bedridden or...?
Just for the last week. Mm-hmm. But it was a lovely period of knowing and being... Everything just seemed to fall into place.
Hmm.
You know, and there was so much prayers, and there was so much. We've had got so much. We had.
She heard the Shrimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
You were reading the Bhagavatam to her. Oh, very nice.
She had garlands from
the Belfast temple. She told Tulsi leaf on her. She had tilak on her. She had Tulsi leaf on her tongue.
Oh, really? After she passed.
Vrindavan dust on.
Wow.
But to be part of that and to be there for that, it was.
And Maha Water. And Yamuna Water. We've had everything on there.
And so you should.
Yeah. And then she heard the bag of time, she was like, my Ishwara perfect to hear that. Because I was going to read the Gita. And then I read the Shnoba. And my uncle heard it.
And she was never really. She wasn't unconscious and she wasn't fully conscious, but she was always there because there was never fear in her face or her eyes or nothing.
You couldn't get you could get a sense that she, there was no fear. But anyway. And then we did the Bhagavad Gita at the funeral. And everyone, that was quite amazing because everybody came up afterwards wanting to know where it was from.
You were reading the Sanskrit.
I sang the Sanskrit.
Oh.
And I got the tune from my Ishwara because I'd been going every morning to class. I got the tune from him and got him to record it and, you know, learn it properly. And then sang that and then said the translation. He picked a few out. And then people, like everyone, was coming up after going, "It's the most amazing thing I ever heard in my entire life. Where is it from?" Everyone. It was like avalanche. And I thought like they'd be chasing me off the altar.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the priest looked really...
No, he wouldn't like that.
Because something just took over.
Wonderful.
And even just everyone, you know, really loving. They love the sound of the Sanskrit, and they love the translation of it, and they love the fact that they were like, because there was all these little grannies coming up to me afterwards going, "Oh, I'd love to have something different at the church."
Yeah, because you've got all of like six
from. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, we chose uplifting. Yeah,
so that was very special, and she had a lot of. But the Maheshwar said, "Well, with all that said, and you know, Krishna says, never know, if you come back, shoot."
Well, at the very least, it would have cleared a lot of the karma.
Yeah.
You know. So, very nice. I was just reading some Bhagavad Gita translations in those funeral prayers, you know, like I sent to you when your father died.
Yeah.
Those same funeral prayers. I send those to everybody. And there are several, some of the verses are from Bhagavad Gita, and from different places, all from the Vedas. And I was just reading a few of those in English, no chanting or anything like this. And my mother was sitting in the front row. Sit down. She's telling me to sit down. No, oh, that's so funny. And my daughter said next to her, "Go, Granny, I'm speaking," you know. She told me. Anyway, a month and a half later, she died, but I didn't read any of those. She wouldn't be happy.
She comes to the grave.
Very knocks from inside the box.
Yeah.
Inside the urn.
You said it again.
Yeah. You're not doing those prayers in my funeral. No, I'm not. Don't worry. Yeah. My mother doesn't like that sort of thing. God bless her. Okay. So I thought we'd read one verse from the Bhagavad Gita, speaking of which. Did you get a chance to look at this book? You know, we had... Was it the last time we were here?
2 months ago.
When Dhaneshwar was here?
Mm-hmm.
And the Prabhus. And Dhaneshwar, did you see him speak at the temple in Dublin? He wrote this book. And this book is fabulous. Really wonderful. I've maybe got 5 pages left. I've read the whole thing.
Say the name for the recording.
Spiritual Economics is the name of the book. Lessons in Spiritual Economics from the Bhagavad Gita. That's the subtitle. By Dhaneshwara Das. Understanding and Solving the Economic Problem. Well, he has gone to great lengths. I mean, this is very scholarly. It's easy to read, but there's great... research that has gone into this, and it's all in there. He doesn't miss anything. Everything is covered. Has anybody else had a chance to read this? Highly recommend it. So I'm just going to refer to a couple things in a moment.
Do you have any copies left?
No.
I think he sold the old six or seven that he had.
Yeah, he sold them all. Were you here that? You weren't here that night.
I was here that night.
Oh, you didn't buy any. I bought three, and I gave the other two away. So I only have this one. No, we can buy it online, too. You can buy it online. Yeah. He has a website. Okay, this is chapter 18, text 73. This is almost at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna Uvacha, Nashto Moha Smritir Labdha Tvat Prasadan Maya Chita Stito Smi Gata Sandeha Karishye Vachanam Tava. Arjuna said, My dear Krishna, O infallible one, my illusion is now gone. I have regained my memory by your mercy, and I am now firm and free from doubt, and am prepared to act according to your instruction. So most of us know the story and the context, which is Arjuna, who is a warrior by nature. He's a prince, king. That's the segment of society he comes from or belongs to. And he is meant to fight a battle on religious principles against some of his cousins, uncles, teachers, grandfather, great-grandfather, and at the last moment he says, I can't do this. This can't be right. So Krishna, that's him, driving the chariot. The blue guy. He surrenders to Krishna, and Krishna explains. He gives him a different philosophical perspective. And that's what the Bhagavad Gita is. It's the whole system of yoga. And yoga means to link with God. So that's what he speaks. He speaks the yoga system, but all of the systems of yoga are included. So now this is at the end of the instruction. He says, okay, I'm free, I'm firm and free from doubt. Now I understand. And I'm willing to act according to your instructions. Here's the purport. This purport is very good by Prabhupada. The constitutional position of a living entity represented here by Arjuna is that he has to act according to the order of the Supreme Lord. He is meant for self-discipline. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is an incarnation of Krishna, says that the actual position of the living entity is that of eternal servant of the Supreme Lord. Forgetting this principle, the living entity becomes conditioned by material nature. But in serving the Supreme Lord, he becomes the liberated servant of God. The living entity's constitutional position is to be a servitor. He either has to serve the illusory Maya, or he serves the Supreme Lord. One way or the other, you serve. So are you going to serve reality? Are you going to serve illusion? Are you going to serve Brahman, spirit? Or are you going to serve material nature? Spirit or matter? That's your choice. If he serves the Supreme Lord, he is in his normal condition. That's what they mean by constitutional position. By nature, by constitution, we serve God. But if he prefers to serve the illusory external energy, then he certainly will be in bondage. In illusion, the living entity is serving in this material world. He is bound by lust and desire. Yet, he thinks himself the master of the world. This is called illusion. You think you're the master of the world, yet you can't control when you'll die. You can't control the fact that you're getting old and you don't want to get old. You can't control sometimes health, disease. Yet you think you're the master. If you stop breathing for 2 minutes, you'll die. So what are you the master of exactly? When a person is liberated, his illusion is over, and he voluntarily surrenders unto the Supreme to act according to his desires, God's desires. The last illusion, the last snare of Maya to trap the living entity, is the proposition that he himself is God. Because we have... Typically in India, when people begin to practice spirituality through the yoga system, the first thing they learn, or what they most commonly learn, is you're God, I'm God, we're all God. And once you realize you're God, now you'll be free. But there's a higher position than Brahman realization, which is that's the first step of God realization. It's legitimate. But it's only the first level. And as you can see, if you think that you're God, you are still operating probably more in ego than before, when you thought you were a meager living entity. Oh, well, I'm God. Let's not forget that. You know. So the living entity thinks that he is no longer a conditioned soul, but God. He is so unintelligent that he does not think that if he were God, then how could he have been in doubt in the first place? How could you be in doubt? How can you be confused? How can you suffer? How can you not know what to do if you're God? That he does not consider. So that is the last snare of illusion. Actually, to become free from the illusory energy is to understand Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to understand God, and agree to act according to His order. The word moha is very important in this verse. Moha refers to that which is opposed to knowledge. What does moha mean?
Moha. Attachment.
No. That's Sangha. Moha is illusion. No. Illusion. Moha is very important. It refers to that which is opposed to knowledge. Actually, real knowledge is the understanding that every living being is eternally servitor of the Lord. But instead of thinking oneself in that position, the living entity thinks that he is not servant, that he is the master of this material world, for he wants to lord it over the material nature. That is his illusion. This illusion can be overcome by the mercy of the Lord or by the mercy of a pure devotee. When that illusion is over, one agrees to act in God consciousness. God consciousness or Krishna consciousness is acting according to Krishna's order. A conditioned soul, illusioned by the external energy of matter, does not know that the Supreme Lord is the master who is full of knowledge and who is the proprietor of everything. Whatever he desires, he can bestow upon his devotee. upon his devotees. He is the friend of everyone, and he is especially inclined to his devotee. He is the controller of this material nature and of all living entities. He is also the controller of inexhaustible time, and he is full of all opulences and all potencies. The Supreme Personality of Godhead can even give himself to the devotee. One who does not know him is under the spell of illusion. He does not become a devotee, but a servitor of Maya. Arjuna, however, after hearing the Bhagavad Gita from Krishna himself, became free from all illusion. He could understand that Krishna was not only his friend, but the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, and he understood Krishna factually. So to study Bhagavad Gita is to understand Krishna factually. When a person is in full knowledge, he naturally surrenders to God. When Arjuna understood that it was Krishna's plan to reduce the unnecessary increase of population, he agreed to fight according to Krishna's desire. He again took up his weapons, his arrows and bow, to fight under the order of Krishna, of God. That particular incarnation, we talked about this on Govardhan Puja when we were at the temple. God comes down in a avatar form, incarnation, to reduce the burden of the negative burden of materialists and demoniac persons, people who are preying upon others, people who take advantage of others, who are victimizers. And that can be done in different ways. So also we see that sometimes here on earth we are subject to natural disasters, floods, famines, storms, tornadoes, different things will happen. This also can reduce population. But particularly in this case, they didn't affect any innocent people. Back in those days, when they fought a battle, they would go to a place set aside for battle. In this case, it was Kurukshetra. They wouldn't fight in the streets, they wouldn't fight in the cities, they wouldn't fight in the towns, they wouldn't bomb the population. They would have armies fighting armies. So that's the way these things are supposed to be done, if they're going to be done. But this is how the negative population was reduced. And from time to time, that has to be done. So when God actually comes in a form, as an avatar or incarnation, he comes to reestablish the principles of Dharma and reduce the negative influences, reduce the demoniac quotient on earth. So that's what was done here. Okay. Questions, comments? Surrender, as we are conditioned as human beings, we think, surrender, I'm never going to surrender to anybody. I'm never going to give up my freedom. I'm never going to turn myself over to somebody else, put myself in the hands of somebody else. Surrender, are you kidding? I'll never surrender. So, you know, intellectually and in terms of discretion and discrimination, don't surrender, whatever you do. You need to stay strong. And from that point of view, sounds reasonable. I mean, you don't want to put yourself into the hands of Tom, Dick, and Harry. that may not be a good idea to surrender to Tom, Dick, or Harry. However, surrender in a higher sense is very important, spiritually speaking. And we have to know who we're surrendering to and what the reasons are behind it. But surrender is Tom Sarva Papi and Bio. Aham Tom Sarva Papi Vamoshi. What's that famous verse? I can't think of it now. Say it, Catherine. Om Tom Sarva Papi Bhyo Mukshi Shami Ma Shichaha.
Surrender unto me
after. Yeah, give me the first two lines of the Sanskrit verse. Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mame Kam Sharanam Vraja. Mame Kam Sharanam Vraja. Which means, Antonio, how are you, buddy? Good to see you. Sharanam Vraja means go and take shelter. Sharanam means take shelter. That's what surrender means. It means to take shelter. To turn yourself over to a higher power. Why? Because you're foolish? No. Because you'll be protected. Shelter means protection. You'll be looked after. Surrender means to let go of everything. I mean, almost everything? No. Everything. And place your trust in God. Complete. Is it easy to do?
No.
No. It's not. It takes courage. Not stupidity. Courage to do that. To let go. And trust that God will take care of you. And there's only actually very, very few people who can actually do that. And they are not the majority of the populace. Even if you explain it to people and everybody sits around and nods their heads, yeah, okay, that makes sense. All right, I can appreciate that philosophically. Well, don't expect me to do it. When you go to India, you see all these sadhus, these holy men, holy people. And what they own, they're carrying. Like a stick, maybe a water pot, and maybe a blanket, maybe not. Maybe a hat. Maybe not. I mean, everything they own is on their person, and they don't have a trolley from the supermarket with this stuff. It's not very practical in India. They're walking, and there it is. And if you drive up to Rishikesh, not Rishikesh, where did we go? Badrinath. Way up in the Himalayas. You can only get in like 2 months out of the year. And we're driving up and it's like 10,000 feet up. And it took us, 14 hours to drive up there. And as you're driving, we're in an ambassador taxi, ambassador car. Driver's in the front, Kalindi and I are in the back. And we're passing all these sadhus, no shoes, walking along the road with all their possessions on them, going to 10,000 feet above sea level, walking up the road, surrendered individuals. They depend on God to look after them. And of course, in the West, begging is not looked upon very favorably where we live. And especially, professional beggars, that's not exactly encouraged. But if they're holy people, they ask for a little bit of food. people give them food or people give them money. It's acceptable there. It's not looked at upon. And if somebody gives them some food, they will eat that day. If no food comes, they will fast. So they are dependent on God. I'll tell you my dream that I had. But it wasn't a dream, it was a meditation I had years and years ago. I went to see Radha and Krishna in the forest. I went to visit them, like I was at that time. I was doing that every day in my meditation. And they were away in, kind of in the distance in this field. And they were looking at me going like, come on, like this. They were waving at me, come on. So I start running. Okay, well, there's something interesting going to happen. Why do they want me to come so quickly? So I go. And just as I'm about to reach them, there's this little ravine, you know, in front of me, dug out in the field. And there is a log across. So the ravine is maybe 3 feet deep. It is not deep. And the log is wide enough for me to put one foot in front of the other. It's not too narrow. And it's maybe 6 feet across, 5 feet across. It's not very far. So, you know, 2, 3, 4 steps, I'm across. So there they are. They're on the other side. Come on. We want to show you something. Okay. And I take a step as soon as I put my foot. And I go out to the middle of the log. So, 3 feet. The whole picture changes. And now we're in a canyon. And I'm about a mile up. And there is a drop down to the bottom. The bottom is far. And there is the same type of log that I'm on, but it goes all the way across. It's about 50 feet across. And they're way, way over there on the other side. And I'm in the middle. On this log. And the wind is whipping around. Like this. Well, I don't like heights that much. Especially from that vantage point. I like hanging on to something. There's nothing. So I was very afraid. And they don't even change. Come on, hurry up. They're the same. And I took a step on the log, and the log's going wobbling like this. So I go, hold the log. Just steady the log like this. And Krishna looks back at me, he goes, no. He says, you are trying to make some material arrangement for your safety because you think that's what will keep you safe. No. He says, you just look at us. Look at me. Never mind all this. All this is illusion. You think this is dangerous. That's your illusion. You look at us always. Your focus must be on us all the time. Then you'll be safe. There's no other way you'll be safe. Now, I'm explaining it. He just said it in a couple of quick words. I'm explaining it to you. And I went, and I looked right at them. And I kept looking at them, and I walked the remainder of the way, which was a long way, maybe another 25 feet. And I came to the other end, and they reached out to take my hand, and he took my hand, and I stepped onto the bank, the far bank, or the far canyon rim. And as soon as I stepped onto it, the scene changed, and I was back in the forest on this little ravine. And so he looks up to me, he looks up at me, he says, "Never think of anything but us. Your focus is on us. Your security, your happiness, your safety is with us. It's not with anything else." So that was my dream, my meditation. So it's the same principle, taking shelter. So the more you're able to do that, what happens in your life? What is the direct result of that in your life? What is removed from your life?
Fear.
Fear. Fear. People are afflicted by fear day in and day out. Different people, different fears. There's only one way to become free from fear, and that is not to build a bunker with 6-foot walls 200 feet below the surface of the earth, just in case. That might give you a little bit of peace of mind, but no. Or you're watching some program on TV about, what do they call them?
Doomsday preppers.
These people are preparing for doomsday.
But you said the 20th, is it?
Yeah, we were talking about that at the beginning, yeah. 21st.
Is it 21st?
Yeah. Well, you're okay. If you're
a heads up, it's a day early.
If you're a day early, you're okay. But if you think it's December 22nd, then you're in trouble.
It's the Mayan calendar, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Mayan, yeah. It's 21st.
21st, yeah.
Okay.
It's fear. Closer you get to God, the less you'll fear. The worst fear is
death.
That's the big fear. And when you die, what happens? You don't die. Your soul leaves this particular walnut shell and it goes off, and you sort things out with the powers that be. You either come back, or if you're lucky, you don't.
So soul leaves because of, she couldn't bear that pain in their body?
Well, souls leave for different reasons. Which one you mean? What soul?
You know, like people dead because they have...
Well, the body wears out.
Yeah.
Or there's pain. Or they're old. Or
time's up.
Time's up. You only have so many breaths. Each soul's only given so many breaths. That's why I have to laugh. I mean, I'm trying to be polite, but when I see these people running, joggers, they're using up all the breath. Dude, you're shortening your life by jogging. Hey, how's it going? He's healthy. He's getting healthy. Yogis do the exact opposite. They stop the breathing. They hold on to the breath. They sit still instead of using all the breaths. But anyway, main idea is to get free from the fear. Okay, let's just, I want to look at this book we talked about, Spiritual Economics, a little bit. Um, in the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about the three modes of nature. We've talked about this many, many times. Goodness, passion, ignorance are the three modes of nature, or sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is goodness or contentment. Rajas is passion or desire. I like the term desire. And tamas is ignorance or delusion. These three modes or energies or states of mind, states of being, permeate everything in the material world. They sometimes are in pure mode, and they sometimes are mixed, where you'll see different energies. So in the book here, our god brother, our friend Dineshwar, has done a really wonderful analysis of how this has been played out historically in our world, specifically in terms of economics. And societies who are in the mode of goodness are concerned about all the members of society, and all the members of society must be looked after and provided for, being charitable. And but not just from the point of view of a welfare system, which is what we think about nowadays, but back in the day, people lived very simply. So you would have a house somewhere, or something like a house or a cottage. Sometimes you would have a hut. And there you would have a plot of land, and you would grow something on the land. You would farm the land, you and your family. And that would sustain you, or you'd take the fruits of that farming, the crops, whatever you were farming, and then you'd go to market once a week, and you'd have your stuff, other people would have theirs, and you would trade and barter for what you needed. And this is economics in the mode of goodness. And it's a much simpler lifestyle. It's not very complex. But people were happier then. Then the Industrial Revolution came. And with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, they built machines, and therefore they needed manpower. So even today, you'll see that in various countries, including third world countries, people are all leaving the countryside. They're leaving the villages, they're leaving the farms. Where are they going? They go to the cities, because the cities are where all of these corporate jobs are. Now, it used to be the Industrial Revolution, then it became the Information Technology Revolution. But it still has taken people out of the countryside. In the countryside, that's where the mode of goodness exists. In the city, you get the mode of passion. People running around trying to get here and get there and fulfill certain desires. In the mode of passion, we are sold the idea that you must have certain objects in order for your life to be satisfied. And this they do through advertising. And now that we have television, electronic advertising, wow. And now we have cell phones, and they have electronic advertising, and the internet. Well, you, in case you don't know what stuff you need, it tells you constantly what you need to have if you want to be, have the latest and the greatest. So this passion, mode of passion, economics, has created an artificial need for things that have nothing to do with sustaining life. And that's more or less began during the industrial age and has been furthered in the communications age. And then we get the mode of ignorance. So the mode of passion is people who are chasing around after things they don't need that they think will make them happy. And they get these things and they might make them happy for a week or two or for a while, and then they won't be happy anymore because the happiness doesn't last. And then they'll have to have the latest thing, the 5.0 version. Because I got the 4.0 one. It's old. It's all my one's old. I can't run the new apps on it. So I have to get rid of the hardware, get the new hardware to run the new apps. Otherwise, I'm trying to keep up here. So it's an artificial market that's created. I don't say that I don't participate in that, because I do, because I'm trying to keep up here. But you see what they've created for us. This has nothing to do with life or quality of living. We think it does because we believe it. We've bought it. Motive ignorance is when people prey on others to take advantage of others, to take what others have for their own aggrandizement, for their own, I need more, I don't have enough, I'm going to take from you and you and you and you. This is win for me, no win for you. There's no win-win here. I get, you lose, I'm happy. I control and manipulate you. So that's the mode of ignorance. Well, what just happened in terms of the economic collapse? That's exactly what happened. And in our world, we have a handful of people who are extremely wealthy that control everything. They control the Federal Reserve, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, etc. They control everything. They control governments because they decide whether they're going to print money and lend the governments money. I'm not going to get into all of that, but that's really what we're dealing with. And so when these people gamble on real estate and the stock market and the banks and bad loans and investments, and it all collapses, then they think it's a good idea that we should pay for it. So these are the people that are in the mode of ignorance, because they are preying on the innocent people to take everything they have and make their lives worse. So it's no win-win. So this is how far we've come. Okay. So that brings you up to speed.
Actually, please ask a quick question.
Yeah.
You know that you can move up and down the evolutionary scale based on what you do?
Yeah.
You know people that go up to the stage where they're controlling the world basically through finance? Are they going up? Are they actually going down? Going to that stage?
Into their next life, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, what are they doing by controlling the world of finance? Are they enhancing the lives of others? Are they helping others? Or are they victimizing others?
Victimizing.
Clearly. Mm-hmm. They're victimizing others. So what's going to happen to them in their next life?
They could be an animal or something.
Well, they could be an animal. I mean, they're going to get the negative karma for that.
That's what's happening currently in Ireland. The government and the decisions they're making.
Hmm. Yeah. Explain.
Well, it's very worrying because the decisions they're making are affecting people. You know, there's a lot of social injustice.
Oh yeah.
Occurring.
Yeah. And the government doesn't look after the people. They're paying the piper. They're paying the European Union. Hmm. The government's first job is to look after whom?
It's supposed to be the electorate. Us.
The people. Not some bank overseas. That's absolute nonsense. So, yes, I think we're reasonably in agreement there. Okay. So, this is a very interesting perception that Dineshwara got, I think, well, from a couple of different psychologists. He says here, life comes from spiritual energy and has its characteristics of personality, desire, emotions, love, and joy in an eternal condition of bliss and knowledge. So spirit is Sat Chit Ananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss by nature. Material energy, on the other hand, is temporary, dead, without personality, and thus without knowledge, happiness, or emotions. It's matter. It's inert matter. Love of death is called being necrophilus, attracted to death, dead things, dead matter, necrophilus. And love of life is called biophilus. You're either a biophile or a necrophile. That's what he's saying. I never heard those words before. I thought those were pretty good. Both of these conditions coexist within each individual and within the society. What is most important, however, is which trend is stronger. Those whose necrophilus side is stronger will unconsciously kill the biophilus side. Those who are more drawn toward death and dead matter will, without really knowing, kill off their life force. In doing so, they harden their hearts and convince themselves that their behavior seems to be the natural response to their circumstances. They'll legitimize. They are prevented by their consciousness of even seeing another way of behaving. This is the only way. There is no other way. So the examples will come in a minute. Persons who can become aware of their necrophilous tendencies may change, but those who remain unaware, continually justifying their thinking and actions, run the grave risk of becoming totally necrophilous, drawn to death and inert matter, becoming lost to life with little or no chance of returning. So now he quotes the Eric Fromm, the psychologist. Regarding the necrophile, Eric Fromm writes, "The necrophilous person loves all that does not grow and all that is mechanical." You watch it out there, you car buffs. "The necrophilous person is driven by the desire to transform the organic into the inorganic, to approach life mechanically as if all living persons were things. All living processes, feelings, and thoughts are transformed into things. Memory rather than experience, having rather than being, is what counts. The necrophilous person can relate to an object, a flower or a person, only if he possesses it. Hence, a threat to his possession is a threat to himself. If he loses possession, he loses contact with the world. That is why we find the paradoxical reaction that he would rather lose life than possession." This is a major revelation here. He would rather die than lose what he owns. And what have we seen in this country? People are doing what? Since this crash?
Committing suicide.
Because their identity is caught up in what? In what they possess, in their stuff. I don't have my stuff anymore, therefore, I am not. I don't exist. That is why we find the paradoxical reaction that he would rather lose life than possession, even though by losing life, he who possesses has ceased to exist. He loves control, and in the act of controlling, he kills life. Look what's happening here. They're controlling the people to repay a debt that the people did not make. They're controlling the people. And this budget is about to come up. And in so doing, what's it doing to the people? It's killing them off. Theoretically. It's killing people off.
It's a form of genocide.
It's a form of genocide. That's exactly what it is. He is deeply afraid of life because it is disorderly and uncontrollable by its very nature. You have to control everything. Man's endless quest to conquer nature, right? You've heard that one. We'll control it all. We'll conquer it. We'll put it in a nice box. Keep it where we want it. An extremely significant characteristic of the necrophile is his attitude toward force. Because that's what he uses. He uses force. Does he use love? No. He uses force. Which means he has the capacity to create a corpse. Can he give life? No. But he can create death. He is truly enamored by it. All force is, in the last analysis, based on the power to kill. I may not kill a person, but only deprive him of his freedom. I may want only to humiliate him or to take away his possessions. But whatever I do, behind all these actions stands my capacity to kill and my willingness to kill. What do we see in our society more and more and more? I don't mean just in Ireland. Is people killing and having no conscience. They go kill somebody and let's go out and... Are you hungry? Want to go get something to eat? Oh yeah, sure. Okay. You know, I've read stories of young boys coming into courts, killing people. They have no conscience at all. They're completely disconnected from the result of what they've done. You want to go play some football? Yeah, sure. Let's go play. So, the lover of death necessarily loves force. For him, the greatest achievement of man is not to give life, but to destroy it. The use of force is not a transitory action forced upon him by circumstances. It is a way of life. That's exactly how this over-government, this handful of people who control everything, that's what they do. You know, no one exerts more control over countries in our modern day than whom? Which country does that more than anybody?
Yes.
The U.S.
Yes.
How do they do it? By force. Oh, we'll send in our drones. We'll send in our planes. We'll bomb you. We'll send in the army. We'll send the ships off your shore. That's what they do. Until you do exactly what we want you to do. Otherwise, you are nothing but the axis of evil. That's who you are. You're the axis of evil. Why? Because you don't agree with me. You must be the axis of evil. That's how they talk. These characteristics of the necrophile do much to explain the behaviors we observe in the world today at the global level. And as dealt with in the past two chapters of the book, judging from the results, the leaders of the world are indeed necrophiles. and have arranged the world in such a way to please themselves, not considering the implications for you or me or the other 6 billion human beings on the planet, what to speak of the non-human sentient beings, the animals. People everywhere are given a way to live, most having little control over the process. They simply do the best they can in the situation in which they find themselves. Yeah, that's
if,
us.
If we make the choice to be left, whatever, ourselves, that will have it'll have an effect from the bottom up as opposed to the up downwards.
Correct. Absolutely.
So we have to start getting like this.
Well, let's see, you have to become more conscious. You live consciously. You become organic and not inorganic. You support life. You approve life. You affirm life on all levels. And that means you don't use pesticides. Also. Because that's death. For example. But because they live in a society oriented toward death, they also develop into necrophiles, necrophilus, individuals. In Fromm's view, this necrophilus orientation is one of evil. You want the evil? That's the evil. We celebrate machines, machinery. Oh, the day when robots will, you know, when a man's half machine, half human, the cyborg, can't wait. And Prabhupada called this a soul-killing civilization. What are evil people like? Perhaps not surprisingly, in his analysis, Peck. This is the guy who wrote The Road Less Traveled, Scott Peck. Peck identifies many qualities that accurately match the mentality, attitudes, and actions of the suffering and death-dealing economic decision-makers depicted in our discussion of the economics of ignorance. The evil people, he says, are narcissistic, lack empathy, extremely greedy, bald-faced liars. They respect only raw power. They do not respond to kindness or gentle persuasion. They create confusion, frustration, angst, and futility in their dealings with others. Is that not what this government's doing, Antoinette?
Yes.
That's exactly what they're doing. And while often subtle, their destructiveness is remarkably consistent. They seek to avoid incrimination. Steadfastly refusing to acknowledge their wrongdoing and instead engage in scapegoating and project their misdeeds onto others.
Previous administration.
Yeah.
Sounds like politics.
Yeah, this is it. This is politics. And he writes, the words, image, and appearance, and outwardly, are crucial to understanding the morality of evil. While they seem to lack any motivation to be good, they intensely desire to appear good. Well, you know, I have your interests at heart. You know that. Their goodness is all on a level of pretense. It is, in effect, a lie. That is why they are the people of the lie. Does this not sound like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank? So, he goes on and on, but... That is the economics of ignorance, Thomas. And that's
Thomas.
Yeah. And that's what's in play. So you're not going to go in there with your tanks and your army.
Should I change this off?
You what?
going to the door.
You're like, she likes to go to the Houses of Parliament with her tanks in her.
I tried that.
That's right. Yeah, you did. God bless him. So you're not going to go in with your tanks and arms, so and you don't want to be like them. So it's really a question of becoming Biophilus more and more and more. That's the only way. That's the only way you're going to turn this around. By becoming the opposite. By becoming the thing that you want other people to be. By becoming, you know, I don't want, it's a cliche, but by becoming the change that you want to see in your world, you have to become it. Unless you got an army. But even then, there's no guarantee. And in Ireland, you know, it's very neutral here. You don't take sides in conflicts. This is a peaceful country. So when it comes to politics. So, questions, comments?
So we spoke about maybe a bit more on it or something. So we know if we need to change ourselves. I think Buddha said to change ourselves is stronger than to change thousands. But
mm-hmm.
To conquer ourselves is stronger than to conquer thousands.
Yeah. Yeah. A realized soul. Prabhupada used to say, he'd say, you know, you only need two or three pure devotees in the whole world to change the world. That's what he would say. So in other words, pure souls who have no agenda but to help everybody. They have no personal agenda to gain power or to gain wealth, or to control others, or to take advantage of others. If there'd just be even a handful of such people, you could change the world. Anyway, I don't want to leave you with a negative outlook, because ultimately it's all in God's hands. So that's why we don't actually have to worry about it and become fearful, because even these guys and all their machinations and their manipulation are not in charge. They're not in charge, even though it appears as if they're in charge. And they might be in charge for a time, because there's always the eternal struggle of good versus evil in the material world. So sometimes the evil will rise and it'll be strong for a while, and then December 21st it's time is over. I'm teasing.
I think that a few months ago, like this thing really, really you say that doesn't matter what will happen, even you're dead, you're still protected. And sometimes I sit in the plane because of travel, though, I sit and then I think, yeah, I'm protected, what happened?
Yeah,
I'll be dead. We're still protected.
That's it.
But then there's no fear.
No.
Yeah, there's no fear.
It's nothing to be afraid of.
Yeah. And then I was, even Dubai, I stay in the 3 weeks in one of the best places in Dubai, Burj Khalifa, and the 21st floor. And then
you were in the Burj?
Burj Khalifa, you know, the tallest building in the world. So my friends, they have three apartments there. So I was there.
Friends in high places.
But you know what they said? Oh wow! Like, and people say people pay 200 dirham to go just to see like there. And I was just staying there, right? And they have the best spot there, because if you look down there, this is the world famous dancing fountain there. It works with the light and every day 6 o'clock you can see the whole of that night. But then I said, no, I want to go back. People say, oh, you live in Burj Khalifa? I say, yeah, but I like my island, right? So I show them the picture when I have that from, you know, you're right? I say, that's what I like. I say, look here, every day look at, it's the same thing. Nothing changes here.
No.
Yeah?
It's all sand.
Yeah, and And I was laughing all night. I said, you can't even open the window here. There's no window.
No, you can't. You can't open
it. But you can see in like a glass where it's just like a cage. You are there. You can see the best view there. And I say, nothing changed. They say, really, Marcus, you don't see. I say, it's all right. What is that?
It's nothing growing.
Yeah. So I show them the picture of Ireland and all the nice beauty. Oh, wow, that's nice. And
it's different every
day. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Every day is different. And there's no window, and I felt so bad because
you're not getting hit by 47 degree hot winds.
Is that why you don't open the windows?
Oh, you can't open the window at that height.
No, like 21st floor.
Yeah, you can for that reason. It's too hot. You'll get fried.
Yeah, but the only way to get the fresh air is just put the AC on in there.
And if you don't have AC, you'd cook in that apartment. So if the AC breaks down, your scrambled eggs.
No.
Fried eggs.
I call them greenhouse.
They call what the greenhouse?
Oh, that's, you know, the window.
The window. Greenhouse window.
Like, it's all the glass and then you can see everything. Yeah. Just when the sun come up, like no AC on, you could feel the heat. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. We were there in Dubai last year.
She excited for it. Going back to January.
Hi.
You want to change? No.
No. Building. No. I don't want to change.
But they're very proud.
You have to do something with all that oil money, don't they?
But it does well.